All right, we're ready for Genesis 37, 38, and 39. This is our outline we've been following. We're going to tweak it in just a little bit, just very little. Got a mistake on it, but not on this one. I mean, it is a mistake on this one. But anyway, we are down here dealing with Jacob and Joseph, the chosen family, and we're about to shift gears. And I'll suggest what gear we're fixing to shift to here in just a moment. But first, let's review our chapter. So we're going to do it a little different, the blank chapter, or the one that's missing. What's chapter 6 about? All right, yeah, reason and preparation for the flood. Chapter 14. Yeah, war among the kings. That's in where Abraham had to go rescue Lot. All right, chapter 17. Yeah, circumcision given as a sign of the covenant. Chapter 22. Yeah, offering of Isaac. Chapter 27. Yeah, Jacob blessed instead of Esau. All right, then chapter 32. Yeah, Jacob prepares to meet Esau and he wrestles with God. Then 34. Yeah, Shechem and Dinah. I want you to pay attention to chapter 36 now, because we're about to embark on 37, that he dealt with the family of Esau. And little attention is given to Esau, but then greater attention is given to Jacob's family. Now, this is pretty typical of the style that has been followed throughout Genesis, where we were given some attention, or gave the writer of Genesis gave attention to, for example, Ishmael, but then greater attention to Isaac, because it's through Isaac through whom the Messiah is going to come. Same thing here with Esau and then Jacob. More attention is being given to Jacob. So here's where we're going to make a little change in our outline. I have had a typo, and it's taken me, I think I went through the whole cycle last time and up to this point before I ever caught this mistake. Right here, chapter 32 in your outline, if you've written this in the margin of your text, that should be 37. That's where we shift gears tonight, not at chapter 32. And so that's just a little tweak. Now, here's what we've done so far in this section 12 to 50. And that is, God is building a nation. And he's still working in building this nation. But he chose Abraham and Isaac, and then here's Jacob and Joseph. But it seems at chapter 37, where we are tonight, where we start tonight, we start seeing this of God preserving a nation. And that's where this descent into Egypt takes place. Now, there's an overlap of these two sections. The chosen family carries us through chapter 38, but then the descent into Egypt goes through, starts at 37, so it backs up and overlaps a little bit. But that descent into Egypt starts tonight. Now, they're not going into Egypt yet. But Joseph goes there ahead of them tonight in our study. So what I'm wanting you to see is this picture, the greater picture of God building a nation, then we're going to see God preserving a nation. And we're going to see that continue on in the other books that we're going to see in the Pentateuch as we go through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, etc. And then we're going to see God delivering a nation out of Egypt, and them marching through the land, etc. We're going to see various things about the nation. But right now we're concerned with God preserving a nation. He's going to send them off into Egypt. Here's what I want you to watch for. Watch for the evidence of God's providence starting in our study tonight. Now, that's not to say that we're just now seeing his providence. We've seen his providence all through the book. But what I mean by that, we're going to see God working out his purpose. And that is, he has a purpose of preserving this nation through whom the Messiah is going to come, and the means by which he does that. And so we're going to see examples where God uses man's free will decision, even evil, like we see in chapter 37, to accomplish his goal. He's going to have to preserve this nation. He needs to get them off into Egypt for a couple of reasons. And we're going to see him preserving a nation through whom the Messiah is going to come, and we see God working out his plan. And so how does he do that? Well, there's a number of things. Watch for evidence of providence. Now, there's two passages you might want to flag here. Let's go over to the 46th division of the book of Genesis and notice at verse 3 that God said to Jacob, I am the God of your father, Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. All right, now God's going to preserve this nation in Egypt, but God's still making them a great nation because when they go in, they're 70 people. When they come out, at least 600,000 men, fighting men. That's not the total number of people. So he did make a great nation while they're in Egypt. So this is part of God working out his plan. Now let's go over one more passage because this is going to be helpful to understand some things tonight. Chapter 50 and in verse 20, Joseph later tells his brothers that you meant this for evil against me. I know what you meant, but God meant it for good. What he's saying is, I recognize God's providence here. God was working out his plan, sending me down to Egypt to get things ready for y'all to come and for preserving the nation here in Egypt. So what Joseph is saying, I see the hand of God. Now, God did work through Joseph. We're going to see evidence of that tonight in the dreams. That's divine revelation, I take. And so watch for evidence of providence. I'm not going to flag every time there's a case of providence. I don't always know. But just watch for some evidence that you see. God's working out his plan of even using the envy and the jealousy and the evil of his brothers to get him off into Egypt. That's part of God working out that plan. All right, let's go to chapter 37. I'm not always spending time with our questions. But in answer to question one, this is about Joseph being sold into Egypt. And so there's several things in this chapter I want you to pay attention to. We've been focusing on the seed promise, and now we're seeing, after we saw Esau in the previous chapter, we're turning to the seed. Does that make sense? To the descendants of Jacob and what happens to them. We're going to see that. Now, so this is going to be a story of redemption, God bringing about redemption. Let's talk about Joseph's brothers' envy and they hate him. Let's kind of divide that out a little bit. Starting with verse 1, his father loved him more than the others, and that was part of the problem of creating some of this envy. That verse 2 says that Jacob, verse 1 rather, that he dwelt in the land of his father, where his father was a stranger. In other words, his father was a sojourner, passing through and temporarily there. Now, verse 2 talks about Joseph was 17 years old. Now, for what this is worth, Joseph spent the first 17 years of his life with his father, Jacob. I'm not going to take the time to trace it, but you might jump over to 47 and 28. Jacob spent the last 17 years of his life with Joseph in Egypt. Some think that's by design, by divine design. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know what to make of that other than both were 17 years. I'll let you draw your conclusion. I don't know what to say except both of them are 17 years. So you can work on that and make your conclusion. But that's interesting to me. First 17 years of Joseph's life, the last 17 years of Jacob's life, they were taking care of each other. But Joseph was 17 years of age, and I want you to start with me and flag some things here as we go through this little outline here that his brothers were envious and they hated him, but there's several things not reflected in the outline, and here's the first. Verse 2, he'd gone off with his brothers and that is the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, and he brought back a bad report. What was the report? Well, it wasn't good. I know that. I don't know what they were doing. But you can tell the kind of boys these are when you see the brothers, how they deal with him a little bit later. So he had brought a bad report and must have told his dad about, or did tell his dad about that, and they must have known that come from him. So strike number one against Joseph. I'm not saying he did the wrong thing. I'm just saying that was a strike in the eyes of his brothers. Then verse 2, here's the second strike that creates this envy. What was it? He loved him more. Why? He was the child of his old age, and he made him a special coat of many colors. And so when the brothers saw that he loved him more, they hated him and wouldn't speak peaceably to him. They couldn't get along with him well. So two strikes so far. All right, now we're ready for part B here. They envied him not because just of this respect that the dad had for him, a greater love, but because of his dreams. Now let's talk about those dreams just for a moment. These seem to be dreams that involve divine prophecy. I don't think these are just happen to be dreams and I was dreaming, I ate too much sweet stuff and it made me dream and here's what a dream. But God is guiding him And we see more evidence of that I think, at verse 11 in just a moment. So he tells his brothers, I had a dream. What was his first dream? There I was, we were out gathering sheaves and... Yeah, mine stood up and yours bowed down to me. And the reaction of his brothers was... Is that what that means? Are you telling us that you're going to reign over us? So they hated him even more. As if they didn't have enough hatred, they're hating him even more. See the envy building. And so here's, I want to stop just for a moment to pause and make the point. This is part of the providence I'm working on, the concept. And that is God's going to use that envy, that hatred. God's not causing that, but God can use that to accomplish his purpose. So God can even use the evil of men. For example, those that killed Christ. God used that to accomplish his purpose. Did God cause men to kill Jesus? No, he didn't. But he used evil men and used their goals to accomplish his purpose and ultimately be victorious. God's doing that here. Now then, there was a second dream, and it got a little more specific. What was the second dream? Yeah, sun, moon, and 11 stars. Now, the number is quite interesting. Because there happens to be 12 suns. So taking himself out of the picture, there's 11 left. So here's the sun and the moon and the stars. And Jacob well understood the meaning of that. And what did Jacob say? He rebuked him. This was inappropriate, he thought. Because what you're suggesting is that... verse 10. What is this dream that you dreamed? Your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow before you. Well, his mother was dead. She died in the birth of Benjamin. So it probably had reference to Leah, who is the one left to be the legitimate wife. That's what it probably refers to. But are you saying that me, and he refers to as his mother, but me and my wife and all of your brothers are going to bow down? And again, that's divine prophecy. God is prophesying through Joseph what's going to take place in the future. They would, and they did, bow down to him. Now, I want to notice at verse 11 that his brothers envied him. So here's that envy building. Again, God using that, not causing it, but using it. But his father kept the matter in mind. Now that's puzzled me for a long time. What was going through his father's mind? I don't know. But he thought about it. He mulled it over. Mary kept some things in her mind. Remember that concerning Jesus. But I don't think there's a direct connection there. But he must have kept thinking on that. And I take it, and there is some surmising, a great deal of surmising on my part, and so understand this is surmising. I take it that Jacob must have thought that this is not just wild dreaming on the part of my son, but the more he thought about it, this seems to be prophecy. That this may be God telling me something here. And he must have mulled that over and thought about that time and time and time again. Did he come to a full conclusion? Well, when he... hears about his son, then he's a little shocked about that later. Does that make sense? But he must have been mulling. God's sending a message here, and I'm not sure what the message is. I take that to be what he's doing here. He kept it in his mind. He kept mulling that over. All right. Now let's talk about the brothers sell him. And so Jacob sends Joseph to see about his brothers. The text says, beginning at verse 11. So they had gone off where? Where were the brothers? Yeah, Shechem, yeah. All right, that's where we left last time. That's where they were. So this is the Dead Sea. Just off the screen here would be the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River. All right, here's Shechem where they have been before. And they went down and buried their father. Remember that? All right. And so they're here at Shechem. And they're going to be going up to Dothan here in just a moment. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm not quite ready for that. Let's go back here. Now, notice at verse 12, he sent him off, said, I want you to go see about my sons and how their sheep are doing, etc., and bring back word. So he sent him off to Shechem. Now, there's a certain man there. Now, pay attention to this man. We're not told who he is, but a man comes along and finds Joseph. Yeah, he's out in the field looking for his brothers and asks him, what are you looking for? What are you seeking? And he said, I'm looking for my brothers with the flock. And he said, I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. All right. Now, let's go back to our map here for a moment. And Dothan is 15 miles north of Shechem right here. And so Dothan, I think is how it's pronounced, is where they were. And so he takes off and he finds them there. Now keep that man in mind. I want to make a point about him in just a moment. Beginning now at verse 18. What happens at 18 to 22? They see him coming from afar off. They start conspiring what they're going to do to kill him. So afar off, they see him, and they don't like what they see. I can't help but think about that expression, afar off. In Luke 15, the father saw his son afar off and was glad to see him coming. They see their brother coming afar off, and they despise him and wished he wasn't coming. Two different afar offs. Interesting to me. But be that as it may, they conspired how that they might kill him. And they said, look, this dreamer is coming. They didn't know how much truth they were stating in that. Here, this dreamer is coming, and it gives the idea of literally the master of dreams. Well, I don't think they understood what they were saying. He was a master of dreams. God had given him dreams, and then later, next week, we're going to see he is an interpreter of dreams. He was a master of dreams. And so they're ridiculing, making fun of him, that indeed this master of dreams is coming. And so they thought they would kill him, and we'll say some wild beast has devoured him. It says a lot about the character of the boys. So Reuben heard about that. Now, why would Reuben be interested here? We'll see more about that here later about verse 30. He's not a totally an upright, moral individual. He is the oldest and would have been held responsible for what goes on with the other sons, particularly the youngest of the sons, and perhaps that's what he's thinking. There's a little ray of hope, of goodness in these boys. When you look at Reuben, at least Reuben didn't want to kill him. I'm not saying Reuben was an outstanding character, nor Judah an outstanding character, but they did something here, and the first one was, Reuben said, yeah, let us not kill him. We don't want to shed any blood. Let's put him in the pit and do not lay hand on him. And then he was thinking, though he doesn't tell the other brothers, I'm going to sneak back later and get him, and I'm going to take him to his father. And so he's trying to salvage the boy without letting it be known what's going on with his brother. Well, let's go a little bit further now. Verse 23 through 28. We're going to make a point about some of this here in just a second, so let's get the rest of this story down through verse 28. It came to pass that when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped him of his tunic, and they put him in a pit, and what else takes place? Here comes along some Ishmaelites headed down with some goods to sell down in Egypt, and so Judah says what? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. He may not have known what Reuben was thinking about salvaging him and taking him back to his father. Had he known that, he might not have done this. And so I take it that he's thinking this is the lesser of the two evils. I hate to sell him, but the other brothers are wanting to kill him. And I'd rather sell him than kill him because he is my flesh and blood. And so there again, there's just this small ray of hope with these two brothers, Reuben and Judah, of wanting to do a little bit of good. But here's a lesson, practical lesson I learned. Remember, Joseph came in contact with this stranger back up at verse 15. We don't know anything about him. Just a stranger came along and wanted to know what he's doing. And yet now he's in contact with his brothers. Here's the very practical thing. Sometimes there's greater danger to our children is not with strangers, but it's with their own family. Isn't that sad? Sometimes that's the greatest danger of children, is not with strangers that we warn them about. It's with their own family that's doing destruction to their faith, etc. Make sense? What a powerful lesson to learn. All right. Now let's start at verse 28 now, or at verse 28. So they sold him for how much? 20 shekels of silver. That's the price of a common price for a slave. Later the price went up, I'm told. But in this time period, that was a general price of a slave. So here they're coming along, not expecting to find a slave. Hey, we got a slave to sell you. And, well, we'll give 20 shekels. They take. I suppose they would have taken it if they'd offered 10 shekels or 5. They wanted to get rid of the brother, get him out of here. And so they do. So they've sold him. And they take him off down to Egypt. Now, if we don't get any further, do you see providence developing here? Because we know that we've flipped over and fast forward and saw the end of the movie. We kind of know how it turns out. I see God working his hand here by the Ishmaelites happened to come through and selling them to the Ishmaelites and carrying them off to Egypt. Do you see that? I see the hand of God in that. Now, if this was our first reading of this, we don't know what's going to happen. They may be about to kill him. We don't know, but we know the end of the book, don't we? We know how it's going to turn out. All right, questions or comments before we get into 29 to 35. Yeah. Yeah. Had to be. And to think how they treat their own father in that, which we're about to see. Yes, ma'am. Good point. Good point. Let's start with verse 29, now go through 35. They took his coat, you know the story, so we're going to quickly notice this, and dipped it in blood. And let me go back, though, to verse 29. I find this interesting that Reuben returned to the pit. He apparently didn't know what Judah had done and had proposed. He had been away from them for a moment. He comes back and he tears his clothes, and he said, "The lad is no more, where shall I go?" And that caused me to ponder that just a minute. I take that to be a statement. I'm responsible. I'm the oldest. I've got to talk to Dad about that. I've got to tell Dad. I've got to give an account to Dad for what we let happen to the son, and he's gone. And I was planning on taking him back to Dad, but he's gone. Where am I going to go? Because I can't go back and tell Dad. That's what I'm taking him to be saying. He felt responsible. So they took the coat, dipped it in blood, and notice at verse 32, they go back and they tell their father, and this is, or ask him, they know, and is this the coat of your son? Well, yeah, it is. And the father concluded, yeah, some wild animal tore him apart and devoured him, torn him to pieces. And then Jacob tore his clothes and he mourned and for his son many days. Now look at verse 35. I've written out to the margin of my text, hypocrisy, that his daughters and his sons arose to comfort him. Can you imagine? The very sons that were responsible for him being gone are trying to comfort their dad. This tells me something of the evil. We're going to see more in chapter 38, and there's a reason for chapter 38. All right. Then verse 36, the Midianites take him and sell him to Potiphar. So the basic storyline of chapter 37 is how Joseph ended up in Egypt. That's how he got there. Make sense? That's all we're trying, that the text seems to be accomplishing. But we see God's hand in using the evil of men. Can God still work in providence today and use evil? Sure he can. God can do anything. That doesn't mean he's working miracles. Miracles and providence are not the same at all. All right. Now let's move on to chapter 38. Now, chapter 38 deals with Judah and Tamar. Now, chapter 38, in fact, I've got a question on this. Let's see. Chapter 38 seems to be an interlude that illustrates the need to remove Israel from the Canaan culture. What do you see in this chapter that suggests that? Well, before we answer, let me say, make a couple of comments, and then we're going to get into that. It does seem that chapter 38 serves as an interlude to explain the need for getting the people down to Egypt? Could God have provided food for them in the land where they were? Sure he could. He gave them manna in the wilderness. So it was not merely that they had to go to Egypt for grain. That's why they end up going there. But could God have provided grain in the land of Canaan? He could have. There seems to be more to the story. And chapter 38 seems to be part of the explanation of that, as well as chapter 37, as well as some other things we've already seen, chapter 34, etc. So anyway, before I get into giving the details of that, how would you answer question number 7? What do you see in the chapter that suggests that they need to get out of here and go to Egypt to make this a better, stronger nation? And even Egypt's going to be corrupting on them. Absolutely. Marriage with the Canaanites, number one. They had learned the ways, the immoral ways of the Canaanites. All right, we had the murders of the men of Shechem. Remember that in chapter 34? We had the idols mentioned in chapter 35. We had Reuben's incest. We have the intent to kill Joseph in chapter 37. The selling of Joseph, chapter 37. Lying to their father, chapter 37. And in this chapter, we see Jacob marries a heathen and then commits adultery with his daughter-in-law. And if anything is accomplished in chapter 37, it seems to me the one of the points being driven home is there is a need to remove Israel out of Canaan into Egypt to make it a stronger nation, and that God does. That makes sense? The Canaanite culture is having a terrible impact. Evidence? Well, let's get into chapter 37 now, or chapter 38. Yes, ma'am. You're right. You're right about that. All right. Let's talk about Judah's family. And I put in brackets there, Tamar was without seed. That's an important point. All right. It came to pass that Judah departed from his brothers, and he went and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. That's in the valley of Jordan. All right. So here, this is where the brothers sold him up here at Dothan, and Adullam is right here inside that circle. All right, that's where he's gone. Now, why did he leave? We don't know for sure. We're not told. But it may have been, he wasn't real happy with his brothers, the way they had tried to kill their brother. He was trying to talk them out of that. Let's sell him, and they did. And that may be what took place. We're not told exactly why but it's interesting that the text didn't just say he went, but that he separated from his brothers. He left his brothers. You can make of that what you wish to make. Now, I want to take notice of this. We'll follow this little graph of the family tree. There was a daughter of a Canaanite there who was Shua. All right, here we have Judah. Now, remember the little crosses represent, that's the lineage through whom the Messiah is going to come. And so he finds this woman, she's a heathen, Shua, and a certain Canaanite, and he married her, and so now he has children by her. So she has three sons. You might underline the names. There was at verse 3, there was Onan at verse 4, and Shelah at verse 5. So here are the three sons they had. Making sense? All right. Now then, the firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. How did God do that? We don't know. We are not told how God did that. Some speculate that God used some disease. Some said he just struck him dead and he just fell dead. I don't know. The text doesn't say. But you think how wicked man has been all through time, how wicked this man had to be for God to strike him dead. But God has a purpose, and I see part of the providence of God again, of because of this man's wickedness, he's struck dead, and there's ultimately going to be something else take place. Even though it was sinful, it's through that relationship later that we're going to see the lineage is going to come. But be that as it may, when he dies, Judah goes to Onan and said, you need to take her to be your wife and bring up seed by her. Well, that's not part of the law yet because the law hadn't come to play, Deuteronomy 25. So later this became a part of the law, but at this point it's Jewish custom. Does that make sense? So that if a man dies, his brother takes her and raises up, and it's not going to be his descendants, it's going to be his brother's descendants is the idea. And so when his brother then tries that, he doesn't want to have seed, so he prevents the pregnancy, verse 9, and the Lord was displeased with that, and so what happened to him? He was killed also. How? We don't know. We're just going to leave it at that. God killed him. And again, here are two instances where these boys did something wrong, and God viewed it as very evil, and yet God had them killed. All right, there's a third boy, and that's Shelah, but he must not be old enough to be married yet. Because, look at verse 11, Judah says to Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house, and when he's grown, I'll give him to you, and lest he, not now, lest he die. Some suggest, and I'll leave it for you to decide, I'm not sure, that he seems to be blaming her for these deaths. I don't know. I'll leave that for you to decide. I'm not convinced fully. All right. Making sense so far? All right. Now let's go to start at verse 12 now. So Judah has taken a wife of the Canaanites. That led to the wickedness of his sons. No wonder he has a wicked son of verse 7, verse 10. So you see we see the downfall of Jacob's descendants. We saw the downfall of Judah's descendants. Is that making sense? Right here in the Canaanite culture. All right. Now beginning at verse 12, then Shua dies. Now here we are. Let's go back to our little graph here. So Shua dies, and that means he is now he's not married, so he takes off to Timnah. Now Timnah is right here. We didn't pay attention to that. Here we are at Dothan. Here's Adullam, and then here's Timnah. So right here in the same Hebron Valley is where all this is taking place. he goes down to Timnah, and Tamar finds out about it. What does she do? She takes off her garment that suggests she's a widow and dresses herself like a harlot. And she sets along the way knowing that Judah is coming. And what does that tell you? All right, she's as wicked as Judah, but it tells me that if she's thinking, I'm going to, I didn't get the son, so I'm going to get the dad, so I can have a child by him, and I'm going to act like a harlot. What makes her think that he's going to stop by and want to visit a harlot? She must have had some knowledge of that. She must have known something of his character, that if he was this upstart, upright, godly man who resisted all temptation, I don't think she would have tried that. That tells me something about her knowledge of his character, that I'm going to pose as a harlot, and this will get him. This will be a temptation to him. And it was. And so, in interest of time, because I want us to get to 39, he comes along and asks if he can have a relationship, and she says, what do you give me? And he said he'd give her this goat, and she said, but I need a pledge. And so what's the pledge? Verse 18, a signet and a cord. The signet was a seal that was unique to the person, signifying his wealth and signifying his, basically it's his identity. It'd be like giving your ID, your photo ID to somebody. This is my pledge. And then the cord, and your King James may use the word bracelet, that had to do with the cord by which it hung. And then his staff that he walks with. And I'll have all that. When you send that, then I'll give that back to you. Well, she's using her head there. All right. So he sends the goat, and his servant gets there, or his friend gets there and can't find her. So this is interesting now. What does Judah say, verse 23? Let's just let her keep it, lest we be shamed or laughed at. I believe that's the English Standard, am I right? And I'm going to paraphrase the end of verse 23, because I tried to send it. I made a marginal note years ago at that he's more concerned about what men think than he is what God thinks. Far more concerned. Let her keep it, lest we be laughed at. If we keep trying to track her down, we're going to be made fun and ridiculed, and we'll be shamed and ridiculed, and I don't want that. Well, what about what God thinks about this? He doesn't seem to care. All right, now beginning at verse 24, he finds out, and you talk about hypocrisy and a double standard, he finds out that he's told she's been running around being a harlot. And he says, bring her out and she ought to be burned. And so she comes out, and what does she do? Here's this signet and the cord and the staff, and I have a child by this man. If you can figure out who this belongs to, and in our day and time it would be, look at the picture on the photo ID and you tell me who that belongs to, and whoever that is, that's the one guilty. And Judah recognized, okay, that's it. And he says, she is more righteous than I am. And he never knew her again. That means he never had an intimate relationship. All right, quickly, let's notice now the next section that she gives birth to Perez and Zerah. And you might make a marginal note if you don't have marginal notes in your center column or something like that. At Perez, you might put 1 Chronicles 2:4. I'm going to give all these again. Ruth 4:12 and Matthew 1:3, particularly Matthew 1:3. I'll give those again here in just a second. What's the significance of Matthew 1:3? Matthew 1:3 is going to show that Perez here, depending on your translation, or Perez in your text, is this guy right here through whom the lineage would come. He's mentioned in the lineage of Christ, Matthew 1:3, Ruth 4:12, and 1 Chronicles 2:4. Got them? 1 Chronicles 2:4, Ruth 4:12, Matthew 1:3. All right. So now Judah has had a relationship with his daughter-in-law Tamar, and now it's through her that this lineage starts through whom the Messiah is going to come. Make sense? All right, now then, our time is running short, so let's move on to 39. 39 is a text with which we are more familiar, so we can go through this one rather quickly for two reasons. One, we're familiar, and two, we're running out of time. So, Genesis 39, Joseph sold to Potiphar and is tempted by his wife. So when the Ishmaelites get down there, they sell him. He was taken down to Egypt, and he was bought by Potiphar, according to verse 39 in verse 1. Now, quickly, verses 1 to 6 basically says he got there in Potiphar's house. Potiphar recognized God was blessing him, and what happens in 1 to 6? Yeah, things begin to grow, and he put things under his Joseph's control. So to the final point, how long this took, I'm not sure. We'll say more about that in a moment if time permits. His age, he's somewhere between 18 and 28 years of age. And I know I'm certain about the 28. And we'll tell you that in a moment. But anyway, he's a young man, and yet Potiphar recognizes God's blessing him. And so Potiphar puts everything he owns under his hand and under his control. And yet the text ends at verse 6 by saying he was handsome. And so that's part of the problem here. Now, Potiphar's wife tempts him, and she seeks to seduce him. So let's hit some high points here. Notice at verse 7, came to pass that the master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. She cast longing eyes. That means that she was making eyes at Joseph. She looked at him with desire, one translation said. She began making eyes at Joseph. Some think that means that she set him as a target. I think it more that she was flirting with her eyes, but be that as it may, she cast eyes on him. Now, I want to paint a picture. This is from a sermon that I think pictures what went on here, that this temptation was real strong, extremely strong, when you consider how young he was. He was 17 when he went off and was sent off by his brothers. And so some time has had to pass, so let's give that a year. He's somewhere between 18 and 28. How do I know 28? He had been in prison 2 years, chapter 46 in verse 1, and chapter 46 in, what is it, 46. And he was 30 years old when he got out. So take 30 minus 2 is 28. So somewhere between 18 and 28. My point is, that's a period of time when desires are strong. And so here's a period of time when in his youth, it's not an old man or a young teenage boy, this is a man who is in his youth and this temptation is coming on. Secondly, she was the one that solicited him. She comes to him and said, come lie with me. But then she also tells him how far she's willing to go, which is, look at verse 7, come lie with me. She's not just flirting with him. She makes eyes in him, and she's flirting with him, but she says, this is how far I'm willing to go. There were few men in Egypt that could have resisted that. The repetition of it, verse 11 says that day by day she did this. And finally there's a convenient opportunity. Verse 11 said no one else was in the house. And she grabs him and says, come lie with me. So I'm painting a picture. This was real, real, real strong temptation. But there were two ways, actually more, but there are two that I'm going to focus on. He resisted with words. So if you're ready to make some marginal notes, let's get ready. Look at verse 8. The text says he refused. That means he said no. And he said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. So there were three or four things, or actually more, that he said in response to her. The first was, he said, no, I'm not going to do it. The second thing, he spoke of trust. Look at verse 8. And I'm going to paraphrase verse 8. My master trusts me. He lets me touch anything and everything but you. And that's because you're his wife. Thirdly, he spoke of the sacredness of marriage, verse 9. I can't touch you because you're his wife. Fourth, he called it wickedness, tomorrow. And fifth, he says it's a sin against God. He didn't just say, I don't think I'm interested. He said, no, my master, trust me. You're a married woman. This would be immoral, and this is a sin against God. He had quite a bit to say, didn't he? All right, he resisted with deeds. There are two things. And this is one thing I've missed for years. And so if you've missed this, this is the night to get it. There are two things he did. Let's start with the second, and then we'll go back to the first. Second one was in verse 12. He fled and he ran outside. He got away from the situation. Might have to do that, literally. But the first thing that I've missed for years. So it was that when she spoke to Joseph day by day, there's your repetition, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. The Living Bible says he kept out of her way as much as possible. New International says, or even to be with her. That he refused even to be with her. In other words, when he saw the temptation, he got himself away from the circumstance. Does that make sense? Practical stuff. Verse 11, he was concerned about his behavior with the opposite sex. At least he was aware of that. Now then, I want us to get back to verse 14. We're still talking about the temptation. That when he did that, she took her garment, his garment, and told the men that this Hebrew came in to mock us. And that sounds like to make fun of him. I think her charge is, he tried to rape me. That's a serious charge. This man, whose garment, this man tried to rape me. And I screamed in a holler, and if I hadn't have done that, he would have done something. So when her husband comes in, she tells him the same story. Now, a couple of things I want to take note of. One is, it seems like Potiphar knew she was lying. Now, evidence to that to me is he didn't execute him immediately. He had every right and power and authority to do that, but he puts him in prison. I think he knew the kind of woman she was. The other thing is that she, and this was one of the lessons I had right here, is Joseph can now see the difference in love and lust. She didn't love Joseph. She's saying, come lie with me. How do I know she didn't love him? Because now she's trying to destroy him. Absolutely. She's trying to destroy him. And so she had lust for him, but she didn't love him. That's a powerful lesson. Teach your young people, teach your children, teach your grandchildren that lesson. And then finally, and we're done, I realize our time is gone, 19 to 23, Joseph then was cast into prison. He's there. And he's going to be there for how long? 2 years. 2 years. All right, we'll talk more about prison next time.